One ring to rule them all. One ring to find them. One ring to rule them all.
Aslan is a lion. One ring to find them. The great lion.
The wheel of time turns and ages come and pass. The wheel of time turns and ages come and pass. The wheel of time turns and ages come and pass.
Books from Earth, a podcast. Relive your favorite books of fantasy, sci-fi, and apocalyptic stories. Yes, there are lots of spoilers. The spoiling is constant. Yes, there can be adult content. We are adults making content. Spoilers, adult content, Books from Earth, time to relive a favorite book.
Welcome to Books from Earth, featuring David Gersh's The Gathering Storm, his first book in the Chronicle of the Raven series. David also has published book two in the series, and book three is going to press very soon, and we are told that book four is in progress. Today is a special episode because David joins us at the pod to talk about all things to do with the Chronicle of the Raven series, and of course, a deep dive into book one, The Gathering Storm. But first, we'll have a word from today's sponsor. Hey, witches and warlocks, listen up. Are you concerned about melting like that poor Wicked Witch of the West? We've got just the thing to keep your broomstick flights dry and your spells intact. Introducing Hagproof Rain Gear. Hagproof Rain Gear, the ultimate solution to soggy spellbooks and that unpleasant melting we saw with Alfaba. Whether you're dodging a sudden downpour, brewing up a storm of your own, or waging batter against a cursed little Bradner pesky dog, these cloaks, hats, and umbrellas are 100% guaranteed to keep you dry. Plus, they're designed by witches or witches. Visit www.wetnowitch.com today. They've got you covered. Hagproof rain gear. Literally. Use the code EARTHSPELL at checkout for 15% off your first order. Stay dry, stay magical, and remember, even the Wicked Witch deserved better rain gear. They offer everything in standard black and a few other colors, because who doesn't enjoy variety? For instance, you can get their gear in dark black, smoky black, midnight black, ink black, and my personal favorite, black obsidian. Stop melting and start shopping, because witches deserve to stay stylish and dry. Visit www.wetnowitch.com today. Use the code EARTHSPELL at checkout for 15% off your first order. This message is brought to you by Books from Earth, where magical minds meet earthly reads. Now back to our regularly scheduled sorcery programming.
All right, and we are so happy today to welcome David Gersh, the author of The Gathering Storm and the Chronicles of the Raven series, for our author interview series. Welcome, David.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here.
David, would you be willing to give our listeners your off-the-cuff synopsis of book one, The Gathering Storm?
Sure. Epic fantasy. I'll start by saying that put us in the correct world. The world of Hortus is the world in which the action of the books take place. It is a world that was discovered generations and generations and millennia ago by the Six, and they were called the Hexafiloi, who are the Six Friends, and they're figures of mystery. Are they gods? Are they just highly technologically advanced? We don't know. They're the Hexafiloi. And these six individuals came to the planet, and they discovered that there were no people on this planet, but that it was a garden-like planet, very similar to Earth. And so they began this process of bringing cultures from Earth to populate Hortus. These are medieval and or prehistoric cultures that were brought from Earth to populate, and it was all very lovely, and it was all very peaceful, and it was all very idyllic, until one of the six found his spirit being corrupted by the research he was doing, and he went from being fascinated with trying to unlock the secrets of the universe more essentially the secrets of creation. And in doing so, he discovered that there's a darkness inherent in that, and it polluted him, it corrupted him. And so then he eventually, in the fullness of time, and I'm giving you the very abbreviated version, but in the fullness of time, he broke away from the other five, and he fought against them. And he began corrupting the world and bringing in negative influences. He became known as Fel, the Lord of Darkness, or the Lord of Shadows. The other five rose against him. So thousands of years have passed. There were great wars. There were great wars that were fought against him. He was eventually put down and banished or killed, or we're not really sure, but he was essentially brought low. And his spirit rests in the fetid swamps of the dark places and the poisonous aspects of the world. Thousands of years pass, and we find ourselves now meeting an enigmatic but interesting commander, a war chief, a warlord by the name of Corvus Korax, or the Raven. And we begin following him as he has been alerted that there is a mass of barbarian warriors, a horde of barbarian warriors that are on their way to invade his land. And he, of course, marshals the troops to rise up and resist against the barbars. He doesn't have the whole picture by any stretch, but he is he's a man of integrity and faith and good heart. And he and his sons together rise up, and they rally together many other troops to fight against the barbars and stop them. What we then begin to find out is that this is a much larger story than just what's happening in his little part of the world. This is something that involves all the areas of the planet, and that it is a far-reaching conspiracy / movement by the now reawakening Dark Lord to seize the centers of power on the planet. When they were bringing in cultures from Earth long, long millennia ago, they had created these four tors, or these four towers or hills at different parts of the planet, and each one is linked to cosmological. So you have one of the tors is linked to the autumn equinox, one is linked to the vernal equinox, one is linked to the summer solstice, and one is linked to the winter solstice. And these four tors are what's communicating back and forth to Earth and with each other. This now, fast forward, Fel has, his forces are attempting to seize the Tor of the Autumn Equinox, and that is where the action of the book takes place, as Corvus and his troops, as well as the other characters, banding together to try and defend the Tor of the Autumn Equinox. They don't even know exactly what bad could happen. They just know it shouldn't happen. Whatever it is Fel has planned is bad. We don't want it to happen. And they've gotten enough hints that it's pretty severe that they need to stop it. So this wide-ranging cast of characters, very disparate cast of characters, comes together to resist and to fight against the incoming, the invading barbars, and to try and stop them from seizing the Tor of the Autumn Equinox. No worries. So essentially in book one, we take ourselves up through sort of the identifying who are all the heroic characters and this wide ranging cast of characters. Who are they all, and how do they all fit into this overall story, which many of them have no idea what's going on. They have no idea why they're, you know, how these events are sort of rushing them along, but they find themselves in the heart of all this and moving sort of inexorably towards a climax, which will bring them all together.
One of the things I loved about your pacing and your plot was you had basically two to four different groups moving with a great sense of urgency to stop what it almost seems like a routine barbar invasion, but maybe a little bigger and badder than before.
Right.
And they know there's these sort of critical junctures that they have to get stuff in place if they're going to defeat them, or else it's the barbers could take the day. So you have Mama and her votaries, her group, trying to get this.
I love Mama and her group. I have such fondness for that group.
Well, they're fantastic. I mean, they're a book in of themselves.
Yeah.
And she's bringing a key to meet this person she's never met.
Right.
All she knows is she's got to pull it off.
Right. And it's around the world. She's got 6 months to get there.
Yeah. Totally wrong. And then she's given the key by Corvus's weapons teacher.
Yes. Swordmaster Ishal, who is the swordmaster to the Silken Emperor. And when Corvus was a young man, he had gone off on, you know, what he thought was a fun adventure. And it turned out to be this horrible, horrible situation. And he found himself fighting on the wrong side of a war, and he didn't want to do that. And all of this comes out over the course of the books. But basically, he found himself rebelling against the mercenaries that he had hired on with, and instead working to try and do what was right in the battles and save the people of Asland, a desert Arabic culture that was being invaded on this crusade. And so Corvus suddenly turned, he was a commander of a company, and he managed to turn that company against, you know, they basically they rebelled against their evil overlords, and they joined the good guys' side at a critical juncture, turning the battle in the favor of the Asline people. And as a consequence of that, and there was more to it, there's a lot to that story, but anyway, as a consequence of that, he finds himself at the palace of the Silken Emperor, being allowed to study with the swordmaster, the grand swordmaster, who is the greatest swordmaster to have lived in generations. So he's studying with Ishal personally back in his youth. And after a couple years, that goes south and he has to leave. But nonetheless, that formative years that really changed his life, the trajectory of his life. And it also then fast forward, Ishal is the one who connects with Mama Warad and sends her on her way to go reconnect with Corvus.
The obvious prequel.
I love it, though. I love that you have everybody's like backstories already in your mind. It helps so much with the world building. Like, it makes everything so clear, and your world really. So I'm sorry. I know we're still in intro phase, but your world really jumps out from the page, and it's obvious. Yeah, it's obvious to tell. And I love, and just another thing that I love is that you use plain language in a fantasy setting. I love that. Okay, I'm sorry. All right, keep going.
Oh, you're going where I was going, which is you have these three different plots going on, different groups going on, each with their own mission, all steered, it turns out, towards a common enemy that we're still not sure about. It seems like there's something in the shadows kind of pushing this horde. You have Corvix and his son, Kaelin.
Kaelin, and you also you have Kaelin and Legal for his two sons. Yeah.
Yeah. And Kaelin and Corvax are trying to like basically rouse the people. Come on, let's get going. We've got to get our armies together. And they have to go through their own successes to pull that off. And then you have Lygulf and Yazeed, who are trying to basically wake up the most sleepiest kingdom, most smug kingdom,
Red
Kingdom, to try to get. And then everybody has to converge.
Yeah, yeah.
This key battle.
And then there's Darien and Kaizo and that whole storyline, mm-hmm. and Zach. I have a great fondness for all these characters, so I love them all.
And well, can I, like, the Lygulf and Yazeed thing, what I love about that is it puts the reader in such a bind where you want that comeuppance for that king, and like you want him to die and like realize the error of his ways. But at the same time, if that happens, then Corvus has failed. So that's probably bad. And it's like, what a great like conundrum dilemma to be in as a reader. I don't like either one, you know,
yeah,
I want both, but I don't like either.
That's fun. Yeah. Angus was a fun character to write.
Your main characters, unless I missed it, and it's entirely possible, or more gets revealed, they're not anti-heroes. They're good guys. I enjoyed that. Like, I feel like I'm so used to seeing anti-heroes or the flawed hero. And these people all have flaws, but they're good. I just kind of would love it if you could speak to that. or if I see it incorrectly.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. The founding of the world Hortus, the original plan was that the people that were brought from Earth to populate Hortus, and this is, you know, thousands of years prior to the action of the book, the idea was that they were bringing over peaceful, good people with integrity, and that they worked very hard, that the Hexaphiloi, the six friends, were trying very hard to really curate and select people and peoples whose cultures would have would stand tall. But they were striving to try and create a world that would be peaceful, that create a world that would be free of politics and all the nastiness. And instead, they tried to create this garden. They really strove, and that's what part of what the tours are about. But that I don't want to get into that because that's later. That gets revealed later. But that there's an influence on the planet towards honesty and towards integrity. And so, like, for instance, in the lands of the Greenmount where Corvus lives, they're a peaceful people. They're peaceful, hardworking people. They're not ambitious. They're not avaricious. They don't strive to conquer other lands. They just want to live their lives in peace and, you know, raise their flocks and harvest their rye and make their whiskey and do their things. You know, obviously, because of Fel's influence, that has changed. The world has changed. So now there are dark influences. So we have the situation early in the book of needing to go into the circle because of what happened to Dallin, and the assault on Dallin. But then that's just a taste, and then we realize, oh, there's lots of other poisonous elements that Fel has introduced to this world, and those are the barbars and others, and the avarice of the church, and how the church is driving a good deal of this. But our heroes are ultimately heroes. I believe firmly that, you know, Corvus is a man of integrity, and his kids, as a writer, when you're writing a father-son relationship, you're writing father, you know, I really spent some time thinking about this, and I just couldn't bring myself to write it in a way where they were jealous of him, or where they were flawed, or the kids were. I for my purposes, for that family to work, those boys have to be utterly dedicated to their dad, and their dad is utterly dedicated to them. And that relationship, that positive, loving relationship, then allows so much of the action to drive after that, because they're coming at it from, we want to do the right thing. And
yeah, I love that.
That to me was just more interesting for this story.
Parenting is like throughout there's a lot of parenting. You're working with it a lot, because even with the votaries and Mama, they might not be her birth children, but she's called Mama and they're her children.
Yeah.
Her crazy nutsoid children.
Absolutely.
You know? And
yeah.
And I'm sure this was also intentional, right? All this.
Right. And it's also Isidore and Darianne. And I mean, there's just, I'm fascinated by the different ways that parenting takes place, and by how that can be an inspiration to the child, how that can send the child sort of spinning off in their own direction or whatever that is. You know, there's a million different variations on that, but I just felt like there's so many examples that other authors write where those relationships are strained or difficult. And I just wasn't interested in that. I wanted the kids to love their dad, and for Darianne to love her mom. Mm-hmm. And
I'm gonna make my kids read this and see, this is how you're supposed to be. Yeah.
I really like the relationship you had with Legolf and his dad, because there was nothing strained there. Legolf being gay, you know, and his dad is like a, in that world, it's totally normal. There's no, you know, he doesn't treat his son any less than his other son. And he even teaches him how to fight another fighting style that's, you know, for artists or something like that. I thought that was wonderful. What inspired you?
Well, thank you. I'm a father of two LGBTQ children. So that's near and dear to my heart. But even so, I knew before I even started writing that one of the boys would definitely be gay, because I just feel like that is gives us a different perspective on the world, and we'll get so much more information by viewing the world through those eyes from time to time. And that just feeds the storyline in such an, and, you know, moving on book four, which is still in the conceptual stages. But book four is really centered on Lee Golf, and Lee Golf is sort of the main character for book four, which is fun.
Well, that's going to be fantastic. Yeah, you had a scene in the book where Corvus defends Ligolf's sort of pride when he's called girly and put down by some other folks. And the scene is one of quite a lot of violence. One might say Corvus overreacted. I don't know.
Yeah, he beat the guy almost to death and left him with many broken bones and a broken jaw and having to slobber out an apology through a broken jaw. Yeah.
Was that particularly cathartic for you to write?
It was. I mean, come on, I'm a dad, and both that and the circle, the scene that is, you know, the big day of the seven, I call it. Though, in fact, the day of the seven was the very first chapter I wrote of the book. I just started with that, and then I filled in backstory and moved forward from there. But I started with that whole story because I knew that would be a quick and easy way for me to invest in the story, for me to get to know Corvus, because as I'm writing the characters, they come to life and I learn them as I'm writing them, you know. So Corvus did not pop into my head, you know, out of whole cloth and all existed. I started writing this story about a man defending a young lady that he views as a surrogate daughter. And she had this terrible attack, and him defending her and her honor and wanting to punish the perpetrators. And as a father of daughters, that, of course, you know, that speaks to me. And it's very easy to get to that place very quickly.
And can I jump in on that, too? First off, we didn't have to see it, which was great. But then the other thing that I really appreciated is that we got Dallin's story. She wasn't just a prop in Corvus's journey. Like, Dallin is her own hero, and we have her through the entire thing. And it's like, and we get to watch her recover and her journey, and, like, you know, she's important, and she's got her own, like, she's got her own things that she needs to recover from, and she has the tenderness of her village and the support of everyone, but at the same time, she has her own healing process that everyone gives her space with. And I, like, just, you know, as a woman reading fantasy literature, so often we're just props in somebody else's heroic journey. So I appreciated that.
Well, you can thank my wife for that. As I was beginning the conceptual process and I was outlining things, I hadn't really written very much beyond the first couple chapters. And I was bouncing ideas off, and my wife stressed that was very important, that Dallin have her own agency and go on her own journey and not be a prop. She very specifically warned me against that. And I was fortunate to then consult with a couple of close friends, relatives that have been through unfortunate circumstance of sexual assault, and was able to really spend some time with them and talk about, okay, talk to me about the healing process. Talk to me about just every, you know, we've just spent so much time talking about the journey and the woundedness and how that's not something you just get over. And it lasts. It's a scar that, you know, and it was lovely. None of this was necessarily new information for me, but it was certainly being told to me from a perspective that I, as a white cisgendered male, just don't get, you know what I mean? That's not my lived experience. So I need to hear this from someone that it is their lived experience. And it was incredibly powerful and wonderful. And I would go for a step further and say that Dallin is going to feature very prominently in books two and three. So
it would seem so. It would seem so. I'm excited.
I like how you, these two, I'll take the last two subjects. I see Josh once asked a question too, but the last two subjects, Lee Golf's sexuality and then the assault. Okay. there is nothing ham-fisted. You just did it so lightly. Is in fact, like, even LeGoff, if I described him, I would definitely be like, yeah, you know, he's gay or whatever. But it might be like the third thing I said about him. And I like that. Like that it's because sometimes when you read or you see TV or movie or whatever, it's like the you can tell the author is trying to hit their notes. You know what I mean? And kind of like how we'll have a gay character. Okay. We'll have a we'll have someone surviving assault. We'll have someone, but they aren't full bodied characters. Do you know what I'm saying? And
yeah.
And you could read the, I could have found out he was gay 200 pages later, and it might not have mattered that much for me because I was getting to know him and where he fit in the community and with his family. And it's critical that he was like, it's an essential critical component, but it wasn't overdone. It was subtle, the right amount of subtlety. So it's a compliment. I hope you're taking it that way.
Well, I know. I appreciate that very much. That was my goal was the fact that he's gay is not the very first. He doesn't open with that, right? He opens with the fact that he's a singer. He's a minstrel. He's Corbis's yeah. son. He's a beloved member of the community. He's Dallin's best friend. He's all of these things. And oh, by the way, yeah, he yes. happens to be gay. Yeah,
it's like the fourth thing, right? Right, and that's why yeah. that's what I like about it.
And it's yeah. the same thing with Darianne. I mean, Darianne's a little more in your face with her sexuality, but that's a choice. Because she's being rebellious, and so she's purposely mm-hmm. choosing mm-hmm. To play the lesbian card a little louder, you know, a little more prominently than LeGoff does. But it's still it's not her whole identity by any stretch. And as we move forward, mm-hmm. it becomes mm-hmm. less and less important in her identity as her character fleshes out more and more.
Just
Josh, I have.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I just,
no, I just, I have like a couple of things. Go, oh my gosh, Maureen. I have a couple of things, but I'm going to let these guys go. But I want to get back to a couple of things. My last thing is related to history, but don't answer the question now. Like, let them do their thing. But what, I'm a big history buff, right? These people were plucked out of different communities in different historic times. So I just want, it's if you could weave in your, perspectives, that would be cool.
Absolutely.
Sorry, Maureen. Go ahead.
No, thing, I want to hear it.
Well, yeah. So if you look at the people of the Green Mount, obviously they're culturally they're Scottish. They are taken from the Highlands in the probably sometime 1000 to 1400 AD, somewhere in that range. Maybe a little later, mm-hmm. but probably mm-hmm. around that range. The people of Lochland, where Darianne is the princess, they were taken from France and Belgium around the 1400s, 1500s, in that range. You have Sudland. Those are largely English. They are very similar. I mean, if you look at historical England, that's Wessex. I mean, Sudland is Wessex in so many ways. It's, from the last kingdom, it's Wessex. It's 9th century, 10th century England. You cross the water and you're over into Orense, and that's very Hungarian, like Hungarian and Russian on the steppes there. They have the vast what we would think of as Asiatic steppes that their horse lords ride across. And then you have Cantabria, which you don't really get into Cantabria too much in book one, but it is mentioned and it really comes out in book two a lot. Is the seat of the Church of the Five, and that's this island off of the coast of Orense and Lugo that is very much very Italianate with Spanish influences, and it's very Vatican-ish, and yet they're their own thing, they've made similar mistakes to what the people of Earth have made. They did a cleansing, genocidal cleansing, ethnic cleansing of the Native Americans or the natives, the indigenous peoples that lived in that area, and so on. But the church is a huge political force and a growing political force and not a positive political force. It's all in there. What I wanted was that every culture should feel familiar, and yet different enough to give us license for it to have its own history, but it should feel familiar. You know what I mean? The Aslin people are very Moroccan. They're Arabic and Moroccan through and through. The people in the southern reaches are South African and Malagasy in their culture, and they use a good deal of Malagasy language. Each of the regions has all of these, and then that doesn't even get us into the new territories, which is a whole separate thing that comes out in book 3 and 4. So I'll hold on that.
Nice.
I had two things that now are not feeling so connected, but one is, since we were talking about Dalin and her recovery story, she ends up shooting with this magical bow, perhaps a bow left over from one of the five, but don't spoil anything because that wasn't in the book. And she kills one of the Angkor shamans.
Yes.
And I was trying to track the shamans, and we got Bloodtooth.
Right. Yeah, so you gave me a great you gave me this question, and I ended up having to go back and document this, so I'll read them to you if that's all right. Okay.
Yeah.
So if you remember, there's 12 Angkor shamans total. The Angkor shamans, the Council of Angkor shamans has split, and so 7 of them have gone into service with the Barbars and the Church to work against our heroes, while 5 are holding back and they are not getting involved. So you don't know anything yet about the 5, right? But the 7, you have Bonai, and his each of the shamans has a unique blood magic that empowers them in a different way. And each of the shamans, which this comes out much later, but each of the shamans is culturally from a different background. They all coalesced and came together in the country of Angkor to study and become part of the Angkor Shamans Council. But because they come from different places, they have very different their names are just very different in style. So you have Bonai, who's the first one we meet, and his unique power is that fear feeds him in a way that makes him superhuman. Singer is the one that Zach kills on the battlefield. He's the one that has the ability to blast with his voice, a sonic blast. Phileanus is the one with the powerful leaps that Dalin kills. And he's the one we meet very briefly, and he's not entirely cogent at the time we meet him because he's dazed and injured and whatnot. So he's not thinking real straight. And then she ends up killing him. So we don't get a great deal of information from him. Bloodtooth is the one who has the power of long distance communication. Geminus, you have not met in book 1, but you will. I'll just leave that. And then Sangin, you haven't met. He's the leader of the 7 that have formed in a faction against, to serve the Barbars.
Got it. So 3 have been defeated. It seems like at least their corporal form has been destroyed. Yes. And
is it 4 or 3?
Well, 3. Let's see. Your Bloodtooth is the one who's still alive.
Right. Right. That's right. Okay. Bloodtooth's still alive. Yeah. 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 Okay.
He's heading for the tour with the Empress. Right. And Bonai was defeated by Corvus.
Yes.
You mentioned the one Zach defeated and the one Dalin defeated.
That's okay. Right. That's all correct. Yes. 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 Yes.
My other point that I wanted to make, and it really goes well, I think, with what Jack and Maureen, everybody's been saying, is your world building and character development do not come at the expense of slowing down the momentum. And this I really treasured about the book. And to me, it's what really makes it special. So much, sometimes the world building just slows me down. And yeah. It just becomes too much because too detailed or too trying too hard or something. And you keep these 3 groups maybe four if you want to include Darian and Kaizu, who are kind of fighting their own Game of Thrones battle back at home. you know, you keep all of them really moving while also building the world and building the characters in a way that it keeps the pages turning as the world's developing. And it's, I just wanted to appreciate that about the books.
Well, I thank you so much. That's great to hear. That's certainly my goal. I appreciate that. It's a lot of characters, and it's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of different storylines to keep track of. And every time, you know, I'm a professor, so I tend to get a little wordy from time to time, and I tend to get a little didactic and pedantic and want to explain things a little too much. And that's when my alpha reader, my wife, would step in and say, just get on with the story, unfold this. Yeah, she's great. She keeps.
So was it her idea to have the fool, who we believe it could possibly be one of the five, kind of, you know.
So Latrans is my favorite character. I have I mean, I love them all. Don't get me wrong. I love them all. I will always love Corvus, but Latrans is my guy. I'm a huge fan of Joseph Campbell and all things mythology, all things mythological and archetypal. And so having spent years enmeshed in Joseph Campbell's, reading his books and watching his videos and whatnot, it's so important to me to have some archetypes in the book that are just true archetypes, you know, that are, and the fool being the one that is always, I've always connected with the most. And
so does Latrans, Jack.
Yeah. Latrans is my guy. Yeah. I love him to death.
Whose idea was it to have Latrans give us the download about the mythology and the world creation in basically kind of one spellbinding flute epic shortly after Dalin kills the Angor?
Yeah. So that just happened. I, you know, these things, you start writing and I'll have an outline for what I want the chapter to be. And you start writing and the characters come in and they have a very different opinion about how things are going to go. And suddenly the chapter takes a totally different direction. And that chapter was a great example of that. I had not intended that would be Latrans' big download, but it just started happening. I'm like, I'm going to go with it. I'm just going to go with it. And so we did. And I was very happy with it after I wrote it. And I went back, there were some revisions there, but basically I felt like there was just too much mystery at that point that I needed to dispel some of the mystery. I had to get some of the pieces a little clearer on the board, both for the reader, but also for the people who were participating, for Dalin, for, you know, the villagers. They needed to know what exactly is going on, so we know where to go and how to use our, you know, how we can be of assistance, you know. But particularly for Dalin, because she's got a very important role to play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can I jump in with some questions?
Please.
I have like a ton. Okay.
Great. So,
all right. So it's like, okay. Ugh. Pull it together, Shanahan. Pull it together. Okay. All right. It's been a day. All right. So you have a background in stage combat. How yes. does that inform your writing? Because your battle scenes were so clear, and like, I love the using the name of the sword form to truncate a whole bunch of movements. So, and you've got that down in spades. So tell me about your stage combat and how that informs your writing and the battle scenes and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I guess the best way, I was trying to think of a good way to describe that today in, you know, in advance. And just like poetry is elevated prose, and it's also condensed prose, right? Poetry, the magic of poetry is its ability to say so much in so few words and with such elegance, right? Stage combat and theatrical swordplay is very much the same way. We study historical swordplay extensively, right? But then you don't want to put an actual sword fight on stage. It's boring as hell. It's ugly. And but you want to elevate that and find a way that you take the critical beats, the critical moments. What are the what is the language of the sword that's being told in this moment? And you all the other get it to where it's elevated and it's compressed so that it has theatrical value. It has an arc. It has a catharsis, as any good theatrical fight should, right? So that's how I approach the fights in the story, because I see them all as theatrical swordplay, right? So they're all trying to just hit what are the key moments? What is the story? What is the language of the sword that's going back and forth? And how does that tell us that story, right?
Oh, mm-hmm. Thank you.
I have a question with that, because in the last battle, Corvus throws down his sword and he has a completely I guess it's a talent that we didn't know about, you know, and he's, you know, he goes into mountain form, which right. I thought was just unreal. Where did you, it's just something completely that's different that I've seen, you know?
Yeah. So years ago, as a young man, you know, as a fight director growing up, you study lots of different martial arts, right? So I've studied over the years. I've studied many, many different martial arts, and one of the ones I was studying, God, back in my early 20s, was a form called Chumukwan, a martial art called Chumukwan, which is a North Korean / Chinese form. It's right in the northern part of Korea, and it is it has many different animal and that's where I got the idea of ocean form, mountain form. Those all come, those are terms that are used in Chumukwan. And I remember watching my instructor doing mountain form and having groups of the black belts coming and attacking him and trying to knock him off balance. And he was like a tree trunk. He was just not moving in the slightest. And they could literally, they were throwing their bodies against him. And he wasn't that big a guy. He was solid, but he wasn't huge, and he was just in his moment, just doing his, and these bodies are bouncing off of him as they're attacking him, right? And that was very inspirational and very exciting, and I thought, well, let's incorporate that in the book, let's make that a real thing, you know, let's put that in the story.
That was an awesome scene, by the way.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. So also the scene that stuck out to me is one of my favorites, because I've got a couple favorites, but one of my favorites is where Darian got jumped in the alley, and you get to see her whole perspective, and that was awesome. But then you get to see it again from Kaizo's perspective, and it's a great bit of character development for both of them. Why did you choose to write that from two different perspectives? And what was going on there? Because it both were important.
Yeah. So I have to plead a little bit of geeky nerdiness on, you know, I'm a theater nerd. Back in 1950, Akira Kurosawa put out a movie called Rashomon.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was a brilliant seminal piece of drama in which he tells the same story from three different perspectives. And every time, each perspective that you hear it, you think, oh, that's the truth, because it seems so plausible and seems so real. And then you see it from the next person's perspective and you say, no, that's the truth. The other one wasn't the truth. This one is. And it's this great lesson in human, in how we perceive things and how we tend to accept data and what's going on. And it also gives us great insights into each of the three storytellers. So I was really intrigued by that thought as I was telling the story of Darian getting attacked. And then I thought, well, Kaizo would see it as in a very different way. Kaizo, by the way, is my one historical figure in the whole book. He's an actual guy from history, Kaizo. But anyway, I'll get to that. But anyway, so I thought telling the story from both their perspectives would really give us, would give the reader a greater sense of what exactly is she being trained and how is she being trained if we see it both from her perspective and his.
Right.
And that was the goal.
That's awesome. Because what was really cool about the character development there was you only get to see Kaizo through Darien's perspective up until that point. And he seems like kind of a hard ass. But then you get that turn from his perspective where it's like, oh, no, wait, he took the lesson that he learned from when he first started teaching her. And this is it's not a facade that he's presenting. There is genuine truth in it, but he knows what it's going to take. Like the character that we get from him is so much deeper just from that one shift. Like his motivations, how much he cares for her, his depth of understanding of humans, like you get all of that just from a few paragraphs. And like, it really jumped out at me. So.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah. He's an interesting guy. In 1547, right? In 1547 in France, there was a very famous duel that was fought between the Cise de Jarnac and the Cise de Justinerie. And Jarnac was the offended party. He was the one who called out the duel. And he was not a skilled fighter. And the man he was going to fight was the greatest swordsman in France. So he hired this pretty sketchy Italian swordmaster to come train him, whose name was Kaizo, Captain Kaizo. And he was a mercenary and he was an assassin and he was a whole bunch of shady, sketchy things. But his whole way of training Jarnac was, it doesn't matter whether you fight with honor. What matters is, do you live? And so Kaizo is, so I purposely built Kaizo into this world because he's just a fun character, but building him into this world and then putting him into that, into the Blades of Sebastian, which is a less than honorable mercenary company, and having him be part of that so that he could be the sketchy, but he has loyalty, you know, and he wants to make sure she survives. At the end of the day, he wants her to live. And they go on quite a series of adventures together over the coming books.
Yeah. Love it. And I'm also just going to say one thing, my favorite line in the whole book is the one where Darien says to the, I can't come up with her name at the moment, but the head like maid that Kaylin like takes to, and she does the makeup and she says, "You're a genius." My favorite line is the whole book is her going, "Yes, I know." That more women should say, yes, I know.
Well, Maddie is a delightful character. That's Maddie, who her real name is Ambininsoa. And she's from the Southern Reaches and she is Malagasy heritage. And she's going to be a super important character in books 2 and 3. Mm-hmm. Super, super important character. Part of the inner circle there.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. Does somebody else want a chance?
I wanted to add that.
One of your favorite. Go ahead, Josh.
I wanted to add that. One of my favorite dialogues in the book came from Darien when she's speaking with the captain of the Jacks.
Yeah, Justinier. Yeah.
Justinier. And she has this moment of clarity where she realizes how obnoxious she is and how difficult she is. And she has a moment of humility where she has empathy for him and kind of gets that she's been a brat, but now she needs to step up, and that she has a lot of support if she needs to step up, and she needs that support. Again, a great use of character development. It was like less than a half a page, but that scene puts her on a whole new character development arc in a direction of that we really needed to see her go. And it was just done very efficiently and elegantly. And I appreciated it.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. She's got a big set of shoes to fill. You know, her mom goes off to war. She's got a big set of shoes to fill and she's flailing around at first and not quite sure what she's doing. And she's got bad impulses to begin with. And she has a chance to do a little reflecting there that's helpful.
I was going to say, like, top five favorite books. It doesn't have to be, you know, that you've enjoyed reading. Maybe they're an influence, maybe they're not. What are you know, and I know if you're like me, that top five thing would be like, oh my God, well, ask me every 3 weeks. I'll have a different answer every 3 weeks.
Yeah, but yeah.
What comes to mind?
Well, I you know, you had giving me a little bit of forewarning on that. So I spent some time reflecting on that today. And I have to say, when I was a kid, I discovered, I was young, I was in elementary school, and I discovered the books of Edgar Rice Burroughs, John Carter of Mars, the whole John Carter of Mars series. Right.
Okay.
And what I'll be very honest, you know, full disclosure, what drew me to the books was the very racy Frank Frazetta paintings on the cover of each book. It was like, hey, that's one step from porn. Hey, that's great for an elementary school kid. Yeah. Sign me up, you know. But then I got to reading the books, and Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, his hero is, he has integrity, he's got passion, and he's a sword fighter. And he's a brilliant sword fighter, and he's way better than anyone else that he faces. And then it's just book after book after book of him, this hero, solving all these problems. And, you know, he's like a superhero, basically. You know, he's got special powers and whatnot.
Yeah.
But everything always comes back to his ability as a sword fighter. So I read all 13 or 14 or 15 of those books before I was in fifth grade. And then, of course, you know, you go through life and you get introduced to all the classics, of course, Tolkien, of course, you know, and then I happened upon Stephen R. Donaldson, the white gold wielder. And those were hard,
sure.
You know, especially where I was a young teenager. Those are hard books, you know, but I made it through and I loved them. And but it wasn't I have to say that it was years later when I discovered the works of Bernard Cornwell. Historical fiction. And I'd seen...
Oh, okay, I don't know. Now you've stumped me. Who's Bernard Cornwell?
Okay, so you know The Last Kingdom? That's the TV show, The Last Kingdom?
Yeah.
And I don't know if you remember the old TV show from years and years ago called Sharp's Rifles. It was a BBC... It was a BBC show that was shown in the United States on PBS. That's where I discovered Bernard Cornwell, was I started watching Sharp's Rifles. You know, Sean Bean, that was his breakout role, right? And okay. I started watching this TV series. I'm like, God, this is great. And they kept saying it's based on the books by Bernard Cornwell. So I went to the bookstore and I looked up Bernard Cornwell. I found those books and I started reading them. And they're like popcorn. I mean, literally, as fast as I could buy them, I would devour them in a day and move on to the next book. They were so amazing. And he is, in my mind, he's the greatest. When it comes to historical fiction, there's no one does it better than Bernard Cornwell. Just none.
He's got a lot of books. And I worship, like half of these books around.
I worship the man. He is such an amazing writer. His Winter King series is, to my mind, the best King Arthur series that's out there. And, I mean, just one series after another that he's written, it's like they're all brilliant. The Archer's Tale, all of them. So I've read pretty much everything Bernard Cornwell's ever written. David Blixt is another historical fiction author that I absolutely love. His stuff is really great because he takes the works of Shakespeare and then he sort of reimagines them in a historical fiction context. And he's just so freaking brilliant. But you know, and then of course you get into Jonathan Maybury, who's fabulous at describing fights in using modern martial arts, modern understanding of martial arts. He describes his fights in a very, very a very satisfying way for a fight director to read. But you know, they all are informative, right? And so each one, you know, Bernard Cornwell's work is probably the best researched work you'll ever see on historical fiction. So if you want to know what it's like to fight in a shield wall, read The Last Kingdom. And you feel like you're in a shield wall. You feel like I've been there, done that. Now I understand it. You know, same thing. You know, it just
doesn't sound very fun, actually.
Shield walls are not pleasant. Yeah, not pleasant at all.
No. How about so any pure sci-fi stuff, or are you? I mean, I guess John Carter is pretty sci-fi. But
oh well, that's
I think everything you
went through. It's sort of sci-fi, sort of fantasy. It's you know, it's kind of kid stuff, but it's fun. You know, I read Foundation Trilogy and, you know, all the classics, Dune and all the things.
Sure.
But what you come away from it all, for me, the takeaway was always the character development, was always the what makes, you know, George R. R. Martin, what makes Game of Thrones, the books, Song of Ice and Fire, what makes those books so enjoyable is all these wonderful characters that he spends so much time developing, and they're all on disparate paths, right? And yet when you find them finally working together or being in the same space together, your depth of knowledge about each one's backstory just makes the moment so much more powerful. That's what I was striving for. And that's ultimately where I've been. That's where I'm going. Yeah.
That is exactly the feeling that I got when Corvus and Mama and Yadira all finally met. That you achieved that.
I'm so glad to hear it.
I felt like I didn't realize I'd been holding my breath for that meeting until I let it go. It was great. Okay.
Oh, that's delightful. That's delightful. Yeah. And
Lupa, I thought, I thought this dude's trying to do a George R. R. Martin thing. I felt nervous. I was like, oh boy, that's not going to be easy. But I thought he did a fantastic job. Actually, I'll be honest with you. I loved the George R. R. Martin HBO show, Game of Thrones. I loved the TV show. I couldn't get down with the books. I tried over and over again. But I like yours. And I think it's a pace thing too.
Well, I need the pace. People, you know, if they ask me for a one sentence description of the book, I'll say it's Game of Thrones and all the rapey bits.
You know? Yeah.
just a little bit of rapey bits.
But it's not graphic. It's alluded to. We don't see it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's correct. Gentle. It's gentle but at the same time strong. So I found Game of Thrones to be very harsh, and the Corvus series looks like it's going to be very similar stories and similar characters, but a lot more gentle, which is very pleasant to read, frankly. I don't need shock value anymore. I have been shocked enough.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Do we want to talk about Hollywood?
Do you want to hit any more?
All my questions answered, and I do want to talk about Hollywood. That was going to be my next one. Yeah.
the Dreamcast.
When we talk about Hollywood, yes, the Dreamcast. Yeah. And this is, we have an unlimited budget. You may not be aware of that.
Yeah, no, I heard you. Unlimited budget. That's awesome. So, for Corvus, I mean, and this is all based on actors in their current ages. I've done multiples of these where it's also like, if I could have any actor from any time, who would they be? But the latest version is actors as they are today. And I would put either James McAvoy or Gerard Butler in for Corvus. I don't know. Are you familiar with the actor Jack Loudon?
I see.
Hang on.
He's in the series Slow Horses.
Oh, I haven't started watching it yet. Yes. I want to.
I love Slow Horses.
Yeah, I see him. Yeah.
Yeah, he's the young, good-looking blonde lead of Slow Horses.
Yes.
And he's Scottish, so in my mind, he's exactly perfect for Kalian. I've been searching for just the right actor for Lee Golf, and I think that would probably end up being quite a search. But someone like Lorne McFadden, who's a young Scottish actor who has that perhaps more slight frame and a quirky storytelling style. For Mama, and I've gone back and forth on this one a bunch of times, but my latest take on Mama is the actress Priyanka Chopra. Are you familiar with her? Yes. She's a Bollywood actress. Mm-hmm. I love her. What I appreciate most about her is that she can play older or younger. She's right in that mid range where she can, you know, and yet you can still see that she fits the model of Mama's youth, of being this stunning beauty in her youth. But now, you know, we could age her and whatnot. Pedro Pascal for Kaizo, Neil Patrick Harris for Latrans.
That's perfect. Just with the spins. Oh my God, it'd be amazing. He could just do all the magic. Done.
Yeah. Yeah. Daisy Ridley for Dallin. And that's primarily because I think Daisy Ridley has the kind of depth to play a character with that kind of range, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And Lupita Nyong'o for Maddie.
She's my favorite. I love her. She's so good. Oh, okay, sorry.
Her. Yeah.
I cast her in everything.
Me too, right? We need someone to read the phone book. Lupita Nyong'o, please.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great cast. We can arrange that.
Good.
I think the difference between TV and movie is starting to break down a little bit as streaming services have been willing to spend sort of movie money on TV series. But what do you think? There's a format that would be better? Episodes of TV a little more chopped up.
It can't be a movie. Movies?
I think episodes, because I mean that was the way I wrote it. Each chapter feels very episodic to me. And it feels like, okay, this chapter, mm-hmm. we're going to deal with this character and this, you know. So I see it each chapter is an episode.
What do you think the best?
And would it be what age would be, would you write it for? Would it be for mature audiences?
Audiences, yeah. The violence is specific and graphic. Yeah, I would want to keep it in that world. Yeah.
And what do you think the opening scene would be? Episode one.
Episode one. Well, that's where I would have the Corvus is outside his house and he's going through his exercises. And Kaelian comes running up and says, Da, quick, it's Dallin. And he has to go running off to take care of Dallin. And he discovers all that. So the whole first episode is the Day of the Seven.
God, that'd be a great first episode.
Wow. I agree. It would be. You can even do like, in Saving Private Ryan, where it's like shaky, like some shaky cam
stuff.
Where, you know, because he's I feel like he could have just dusted everybody, but he didn't, right? He got that injury, you know, and mixed in with there, which I get that. And I just feel like it would just be frenetic.
Yeah, that whole Day of the Seven where he's fighting each one and he's reluctantly fighting. I mean, he doesn't want to kill. Yeah. He could easily kill all seven in his sleep.
Exactly.
And right. He doesn't want to. He feels, you know, obligated and he has to make a statement.
He's on
it
has to be done.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's on
it. And the Smith, you know, the John, the Smith, who is the father of Smitty, right, in the Day of the Seven, he's the one who interrupts the circle. Their relationship obviously becomes strained after that, but you can only imagine what the father is going through as he's having to step out of the circle and watch his son die, you know.
Another parenting moment.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it was handled was another one of those that was handled gently but beautifully, you know, and you really understand, because it's one so often we want to side with we're the author railroads people to side with the hero. And it felt like you went to extra effort to make sure that it's like, no, that guy's got a perspective, and in different circumstances, that might be mine, you know, that might be me, you know, and I loved the compassion that he was treated with. Yeah.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah, it also tells you a lot about the town
mm-hmm.
that they're in, that dad has to, in some ways, accept it, right? Or, you know, swift justice, harsh justice, but he knew like this is going to be a horrible pill to swallow, but this is it. I mean, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's just totally unacceptable pain, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I whole scene was very cathartic. Was a great word. I appreciated you putting that out there. It was very cathartic to write that whole thing, and explore the different fighting styles and the different weapons that were involved and all the different things. But more than anything, I was introducing both the reader and myself to Corvus in the course of that chapter. I was getting to know my hero, And by the end of it, I was like, okay, I got this guy. All right, let's go. It's fun.
So your next book, the next book in the series, The Fury, right?
The Fury is book two, yeah. Yep. So the book two just picks up exact. So what? Here's what happened. The pandemic happened. I suddenly found myself with no more excuses to not write. You know, we all make excuses to put off life goals. I had no more excuses, so I just started writing. And I wrote and I wrote and I wrote every day. I would sit at my computer for 7-8 hours a day just writing. And before I knew it, I had written all three books, but I hadn't divided them up into three books. So I just had one big story. And I had written the whole thing. And so then I went in and found a good stopping place for book one. And then book two just literally just starts right where book one stops. And then same thing happens with book three. It just the three books just are one continuous story that follow all the way through to the Equinox tour.
Mm-hmm. What a torrent of creativity. Yeah. The agony, the ecstasy. I don't know. It was just I just can't. It sounds like you were in some kind of real state there to be able to.
It was lovely. It was really lovely. I look forward to finding that again because that was magic.
That's great. How about a little preview of some of the stuff we'll see in The Fury without spoiling anything?
Okay, well, you're going to get some new characters. You're going to get more in-depth into the involvement of the Church of the Five and who are the players there. And then there's both good guys and bad guys that you're going to meet in that environment where there are corrupt individuals who are doing, you know, who are moving levers of power against the countries of the island of Daffod. But then you also have some stalwart good folks that we're learning are maybe allies of Latrans or allies of someone that are working against or trying to slow the progress of the church in doing these things. You get to know more about the Blades of Sebastian, the mercenary company that Kaizo is a member of, and their history. You get to know a good deal more about Maddie and Maddie's background and why is Maddie there? Because Maddie is from the Southern Reaches, which is the furthest continent away. It takes months by ship to get there. It's not something that could easily just happen. It's not like they have a bunch of immigrants from the Southern Reaches that live in Daffod. They don't. So seeing somebody from the Southern Reaches that lives there is very unusual. So why is Maddie there? And that all gets fleshed out. And there's more Angor shamans and there's more of the Barbar hierarchy that we get introduced to, as well as more about Empress Joka's background. So in Orentz and all of that.
So you have The Fury is already out. It's available today.
Yeah.
And you have a book three.
So that book three is called The Equinox Tour. So that's where everything is finally coming to a head. We're actually going to experience the battle for the tour, but also there's other things that have been put in motion that are happening elsewhere that are also coming to a head. So book three is kind of the conclusion of this story arc, but there's a lot else that's still going on that will carry on into other books.
So that's awesome.
I cheated a little. So when I got your book, I listened to the book on audiobooks because I'm in school, I work, so I was busy. So every time I pick up a book, I'll fall asleep. And I was like, this is not working, you know. And you know, I did this with Brandon Sanderson. I did this with so many other people, too, just because, every time I picked up a book, it was like 11:30 at night. So I listened to your book. And when I was reading your book, you know, in my head, I was reading it as, you know, just normal English. And then that's when I connected the two with the Scottish. Now, you're the reader of the book. Where did you find I would say almost perfect Scottish accent.
So my wife and I play in a Scottish rock band, a Celtic rock band. So being, I wear a kilt all the time. I'm constantly out there doing.
Are you wearing a kilt surrounded. Now? Are you
wearing a kilt, Dave? Not at the moment, but I often do. Okay. In fact, here's my sporran. I've got it right next to me here. You know.
I love it. So, all right.
But so the being immersed in the Scots world and the Celtic world is a big thing. That's probably good enough. Yeah.
Have you done like 23andMe or anything like that to see where your DNA hails from?
My sister has, and so yeah, we're primarily Scots heritage, Scots and Irish, but mostly Scots, and then with some typical Northern European mutt kind of stuff.
Northern European. Same here. I did it. I got my wife got it for me for birthday. I'm 46% Scottish. Mix of, and then everything else is like Irish, and then 6% Northern European. Yeah.
And sadly, so many of us that are Scots Irish, what that really means is we were originally Scots, and then after Culloden, when a bunch of the Scots were kicked out of Scotland, they were sent over to Ireland to oppress the Irish. So that was my people. We were also.
Well, at least it was a high point. It was a high point for us to get to be oppressors.
And then we headed over to the New World.
So, David, you have the first three books. They're pretty much done. What are you trying to do to get? I mean, there's so much untold story still going on here. We got three more tours. We got some prequel possibilities. Have you been able to sort of return to the world and let the world just be typed through your fingers some more? Do you have other projects in the future?
That's a great question. I just recently wrote a little preview prologue that is going to be published at the tail end of book three. That is it's the prologue for book four, right? So I just wrote that, and that's opening up a whole new chapter, a whole new part of the world, an area where we have not so far explored in this world. It's over on the eastern side of the Orensian steppes. I don't want to give anything away, but in book four, we're heading into new territory. And that is, I'm slated to actually have surgery coming up. I'm getting a hip replaced. I'm an old man. And so I'm getting my hip replaced in mid-December. And so I'm going to be flat on my back for a few weeks. And while I'm flat on my back, I'm just going to have my laptop in my lap, and I'm just going to be typing away. Book four is getting started.
Good for you.
So are we going to go in like a Discworld fashion where it's like you get the one line here, the line of characters here, and then the line of characters here, and that's how like...
You know, I my plan right now is to continue just letting the character list sort of blossom the way it has been.
Yeah.
And just keep following... Because everyone's got a story to tell. Darian and Kaizo and Maddie have a very important story to tell in book four that's completely separate from some of the other characters, Legolf and some of the other characters. And then Kaelian and there's stuff going on. So I don't want to give away too much, but everyone still has their journey. And then we'll be checking back in with folks that maybe aren't as involved, but they're still important to the, it's like a family album. You still want to know that they're there, you know, how's it going?
Yeah.
Well said. Love it.
What, David, where can our listeners find you on the web or?
My author website is just my name. It's daviddersch.com. So it's all lowercase, no dots or anything, just daviddersch.com. That gets you to my author website. Or you can find me on Facebook, David. You can find me on Facebook, or you can find me on Instagram, David Dersch Author. Any of those will work. You can find me on Amazon. My audiobooks are available, on every platform. And my books currently are just on Amazon, although I'm going to be moving them to all the other platforms here when I put out book three. When that comes out, I'm going to all the platforms.
What about your Celtic rock band?
The name of the band is Erin's Call. Erin is the Gaelic term for Ireland. So it's Erin, E-I-R-E-A-N-N'S. So we picked a name that no one can spell correctly. that's just the way it is. But it's Aaron's Call is the name of the band. And we are performing. We'll be at a bunch of festivals in 2025 all over the southeast part of the United States.
Brilliant.
Well, David, thank you for joining the pod, Books from Earth. We just really enjoyed your book. We hope that more people pick it up and read it. My copy of The Fury is arriving tomorrow. I can't wait to dive back in.
Awesome. And awesome.
Looking forward to book.
Yeah, man.
Well, I sure appreciate you guys taking the time. Man. This has been great.
Yeah, I'm so happy for you. Keep it up, man. I loved it. Yeah. It was a great book.
Great. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you. Cheers.
Well, that was fun.
That was fun.
That was.
I love these author interviews, man. They're really cool.
Another enjoyable author interview here at Books from Earth. You can find David at daviddoerch.com. That's daviddoerch.com. And purchase his books on Amazon. We'll include all the links in the show notes. We also want to thank Hagproof Rain Gear for sponsoring this episode, where you can find all of your witch rain gear at www.wetnowitch.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please take a moment to subscribe, rate us, or visit our website, booksfromearth.com. Earth makes great books. Come relive them with us. So long, and until next time.